You're supposed to be my friend!
Friend? Do you even know my real name? It's Revolio Clockberg Jr. I belong to an entire species of gear people. Calling me gearhead is like calling a Chinese person Asia face. No, not twigs!
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul. That is Simon Cornell, and
yes,
we're off to the races on this one.
Yeah, we are.
We're a week late because you were dying.
I was just dead. I've been sick for about 9 days straight. I came out down with one of those really sudden onset cold flu things. Just hit me like a sledgehammer. And it still hasn't gone. You'll hear me sort of coughing and clearing my throat a bit. I'm mostly healthy again, but damn, just 9 days sick.
Comes from doing 6 to 8 shows a day.
That'll do that. That'll do it.
Turns out your body doesn't like that.
Slows the healing process. A lot of energy goes into that, leaving minimum left for the immune system.
And I think for you, Steve Martin has this theory that if you're working, you will not get sick. But the second you just take a break, a day or two off, that's when your body realizes, oh, I don't have to keep protecting myself. I can get a break. And that's when you get sick.
Well, also when you've had no break for basically 2 months.
Yes.
You know, that 1 or 2 days a week is not a sufficient break to sustain you. I was noticing that. We had that week off, miraculously, which for me came halfway through the contract. There was a week off for remodeling. And I spent that entire week on the couch. Just pretty much, I barely left my apartment. I just lay there watching TV. And normally when you do that, when you do nothing for a day, you feel like crap at the end of the day. I didn't. I felt great. And that was a real sign that my body just needed the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a week for me to recuperate. And that was after about 6 weeks of performing. Which made me just realize how unsustainable, at least for me, this kind of performing schedule is.
Yeah, I don't know how anybody could do this for longer than once again, it's all relative.
Yeah.
It's not rocket surgery. Yeah. We have the easiest job in the world. It's just, as we were explaining yesterday to our lovely maitre d' at our local restaurant, Ariana, I will leave her last name nameless, mainly because I don't know it.
I was about to say, I don't even think we know her last name. She runs the one restaurant that's nearby. There's only one. There's nothing else nearby.
If you're in Macau, you go to Jack's restaurant.
Jack's Kitchen.
Jack's.
J-A-K.
J-A-K, because that's how
it's
they
great.
Spell it in China.
A little oasis of quality Western food.
And we're like complaining about how tired we are to this girl who's literally at a restaurant 12 hours a day, running around, taking orders from angry Chinese people. So, we understand how relative it is, but we also just said, yes, what we do isn't hard, but it's just mentally taxing.
It's hard. It's
not hard.
It is freaking hard.
We're not teaching
someone else to do this.
Sixth graders. It's not hard.
I've taught sixth graders. That's hard. This is also hard. I used to work 14-hour days at a Fortune 500 business consulting company. All right? That was hard. This is also hard. They're both hard.
Good. Okay.
It's not as hard. It's hard in different ways.
See, I'm playing to the people yelling at us. You're playing to the people going, yeah, it's freaking hard.
Look, there are way worse things. That I completely agree with. This is definitely in the upper, you know, few percentage of good jobs in the world. But still hard.
Yeah.
Still not easy. Let's not pretend it's easy.
We got on the topic yesterday about thinking like a bronze medalist, which is kind of a 180 from what we were just discussing, but to throw a positive at it, what did you mean by that?
This was, I can't remember where this is from. This is from someone's book about something. That's my terrible attribution. We'll try and put this in the description. I'll look it up. But this came up because a while back in 2009, I tied for third place at FISM, World Championships of Magic. Don't call it the Olympics of Magic. It's not the Olympics. It's nothing like the Olympics. Because for so many reasons, that's a whole different thing. Anyway, very proud of my award.
You don't have to dope to do it. That's
yeah.
Exactly. Well, maybe you do. I don't know.
Or have one testicle. that was Tour de France. That's not even... Anyway,
yeah.
Very proud of my award, right? Just because it's not the Olympics doesn't mean I'm not very proud of it. World Championships of highly subjectively judged magic.
Yes.
And when you come first, it's the best, yay. When you come second, there is that frustration of having missed out on first. When you come third, there is the sort of elation of not having come fourth. But the thing is, because I tied for third place, if you come third, fourth place might have been a lot worse than you. So you could have still done a bit worse and still come third. But when you tie for third, when you come equal third, you are never closer to having had nothing at all. You know, if I'd been 1/10 of a point lower, I would have been fourth and hence nothing. You know what I mean? It was only because I was exactly equal
so you, with the other third place. So you're a much more grateful person for coming in third place as opposed to second place.
Exactly. And believe me, coming equal third, even more grateful than that. Because, again, if you come third, you could have done worse and maybe still come fourth. I mean, still come third. But when you come equal third, a fraction worse, and you would have nothing.
So keep everything relative and just see the world as if it's a brunt. Yes, you could be doing better, but you also could be doing way worse.
Yeah, comparing yourself to what you avoided missing out on rather than what you are missing out on. Comparing what you've got to what if you didn't even have that. What if you had something much worse than what you've got? You know, rather than trying to get rather than looking at the best deal that you could have got, if you got, you know, the second or third best deal, look at all those much worse deals that you managed to avoid. You know, you're actually doing very well, no matter how you're doing.
Speaking of that, we got onto an interesting topic today. Once again, going back to Rick and Morty, a television show that we both enjoy, and I think many people enjoy.
It's a very popular show.
You were just talking... Cripes, I lost my train of thought. You were just talking about... you get to a point where you've seen so many things career-wise fail that you begin to not worry about it as much anymore.
Yeah.
And you were discussing certain...
Oh, yeah. I'm actually finally watching Rick and Morty Season 2 right now. I've been way behind for a long time.
If you like weird science... shows that talk about different dimensions but also focus on the family, you should. I'm going to be just editing the crap out of this episode. If you're going to cough, it's like that line from Wayne's World. If you're going to spew into this. But yeah, if you like strange, absurd scientific shows that are very funny and weird.
Touch on existentialism and chaotic uncertainty of reality and the core of humanity itself in all its horrifying darkness. That's Rick and Morty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but this relates to career stuff in the way of you being... You've experienced setbacks and you've experienced things falling apart to the point where you don't worry about it as much
anymore. One of the things I noticed watching Rick and Morty is that Rick... You know, to the average viewer, comes across as a very callous, uncaring character. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, for example, this is not a specific plot point, so it's not even a spoiler. He'll watch, you know, thousands of life forms die and go, meh, oh well, shit happens, you know, shit happens, and Morty is horrified, going, well, Rick, all these aliens died, you know, what's... Rick's like, meh, you know, because Rick, and you realize, has seen universes die. He's seen... billions, trillions, gazillions of things die because the universe is random, chaotic, and makes no sense. And once you've seen billions die, a few thousands, really, man, it really isn't a big thing in the scheme of things compared to what you've witnessed. Whereas if you've only seen nobody die, seeing thousands die is a horrifying thing. And that's sort of, you know, like actual death as a metaphor for just thinking about the things I've seen come and go and fail in my own experience in life so far, and I see less experienced magicians or people get really up in arms about, oh, what if this doesn't work out? And it's like, you know what, it'll fail and you'll be sad and you'll lose a lot of money, and then that's what'll happen. That's a thing that happens, and they're terrified because they've never experienced that before. So to them, it's the worst thing they can imagine. Because I'm like, I've seen that happen a heap of times, and it stops being a big deal because it's just not a big deal. It's like when you see a kid fall over and scrape their knee and burst into tears. That's because that is the worst pain that kid has ever experienced in their life to date. They have never experienced more pain than that, ever. It's the worst thing. So, of course, they're distraught about it. Whereas you're an adult, you scrape your knee, meh. You know, you've dealt with a gazillion worse pains than that. It just doesn't seem like a big deal in comparison. Just the intense relativity of experience. And so as you get older, and if you do more stuff, and if you get out there and take risks and live on the edge and... You know, whichever definition of whatever edge you're trying to live on, commercially, creatively, experientially, things that would have bothered you when you were less experienced and or younger, and or do bother other younger or less experienced people, just stop bothering you as much and just don't seem as big a deal, and can come across as callous as a consequence.
And that's something that one of my favorite books on, I'm going to get to this in a sec, but just trying to come up with new material, come up with ideas. My favorite books I read was, or I had a man read to me, I should say, because I listened to the audiobook, was Creativity Inc. It's one of the founders or creators of Pixar. I can't remember now. But it talks about their whole process and what they go through. And one of the best points in the book is that failure is necessary, because you that's really the only way you grow, and that's only the way you stumble upon new ideas. And I think that's something that is not encouraged enough in the education system, at least in the States. I remember growing up being made to feel foolish anytime I failed or got something wrong. But in reality, if you look back, those are the only times I've actually learned stuff or retained stuff is by failing. So I think it goes, that kind of segues a little bit into what you were talking about.
Yeah, completely. And sort of this whole thing of, you know, not stigmatizing failure it's sort of, to me, that's now so taken as read as it's sort of, when someone discovers, quote-unquote, that, it's like, oh, that's adorable, you didn't already know that.
Mm.
It's just such a basic tenet of human achievement that you have to fail at a whole bunch of stuff all the time, constantly. It's sort of like discovering gravity and going, oh, my God, there's this invisible force that holds us to the Earth, whoa, and you're like, yeah, no shit. Like, we've known that for a century, you know, it's not, that doesn't feel like a big discovery
anymore. No, I think it's an obvious thing, but what I'm saying,
so many people still don't know it. You know, so many people are still have unhealthy relationships.
When I heard that wasn't a revelation. What was a revelation is they talk about nurturing failure, because you're told that failure is bad, and yeah, you're gonna fail, but eventually you won't. But what's important is failure is necessary, and failure is a good thing because you grow from that. And yeah, that on the surface is a basic concept, but I think it's missed a lot and taught incorrectly.
Yeah. Well, there's also that wrong idea that you eventually won't fail. Like, there's no point at which you'll stop failing.
No, yeah, it's never going to stop. And that's the myth and the lie we're taught, I think, growing up, is, you know, you have to achieve this level of perfection. You know, you're told you can be an astronaut. You, too, can be the president. And just weird, like, pressures to do these amazing things, and then I think people get overwhelmed by it and don't know what to do and aren't taught the correct path, which is you're going to screw up, you're going to keep screwing up, but hopefully you find yourself in those, you know, details.
Well, I just noticed I was even going further with that a lot, because, you know, I do a lot of design and research and development and engineering and crafting, mostly on magic stuff, but, you know, building and designing things, trying to, you know, literally push the boundaries of possibility on what, particularly making impossible objects and things like that. And one of the things I've realized is when I am, for example, trying to put a coin in a bottle, for real coin, you know, metal coin, glass bottle, one of those, you know, ultimate pseudo impossible goals, and many other similar objects, I realized I would come up with a method that I was pretty certain wouldn't work, but I would try it anyway, because I noticed over time, over doing this repeatedly, that even if I was 99% certain this wasn't going to work, by doing it and watching it, as predicted, fail to work, I would almost always discover something more about the objects or materials or things I was working with, that in the process of doing the predicted failure, I would actually learn something that would eventually lead to an idea that worked, by going through the failure, even though I knew it was going to fail. And then on the flip side, there is that 1% of the time where it turns out I was wrong and the method I was certain was going to fail actually worked miraculously. That usually doesn't happen, but every now and then. And so doing things that will fail, I know this with magic routines where I'm coming up with ideas, where I'm like, okay, I'm pretty sure this isn't going to work, but let's try it anyway to see the exact way in which it doesn't work. Because sometimes you're right that it doesn't work, but you were wrong about exactly why and how it didn't work. And it failed in a different way than you thought it was going to fail. And in doing so, that gave you useful information about the medium that you're working with that can then be applied to a better theory that will then fail in a different way, and then so on and so on upwards. So doing things like this idea that you aim for success and failure is what happens if you miss that. But you can actually even go in expecting failure, doing it anyway, in order to learn about what you're working with.
Sure. Yeah, totally.
Just not worrying about it. Just going...
Last week's or 2 weeks ago at this point, we got into like some deeper depression, depression. And I think it was a very important breakthrough. I walked away from that just feeling pretty good. I felt like we covered some topics and genuinely discovered or explored some unspoken things about doing this for a living.
That's why it's important to talk about that stuff.
Yeah. And
because then less people commit suicide.
Yeah, totally. And so I mean, in my dream journal after shows, I've been journaling less just because it's causing me to overthink shows, which is a bad thing. You don't want to overthink and overprocess. I'm trying to only jot down the nuggets of things, discoveries I made. So this show, I discovered that doing this works, and or doing this doesn't work, you know, X, Y, Z. But I started just writing a number, 1 to 10, after every show. You know, 1 being super depressed, 10 being pretty happy, as opposed to where I was performance-wise, depression, happiness-wise. And this way I have a log, essentially, of how I was feeling, how I see the arc go down, how I see it go up. So that way when it happens, when I'm really at a low point, I can reference it and go, okay, it hasn't been this bad in a while, but I have had it before, and it'll get better. And it sounds like a very simple, silly idea, but I think it's going to help me out in the long run.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's an experiment I'm trying right now.
So it's funny how just that importance of keeping perspective over time, and it's so difficult to do. It made me think, we were talking about before we started today, I've sort of, and I think this is also because I've been watching a lot of Rick and Morty, and so I'm thinking a lot of existential thoughts, but I'm finding it hard to remember, was there life before this contract? Is there a universe outside of Macau?
I just want to say that I was waiting for you before we grabbed lunch, and you walk out of the elevator and go, what is life? Like, that's the first thing you said to me. And I go, no, I'm the depressed one. You're the upbeat one. Or else this doesn't work.
I'm just existentially uncertain right now. Like, what is life? Shout out. Hi, Marcy. Hi, Marcy Hume. How are you doing? It's weird. You know, it's not like I don't know that there's a universe or a world outside of here, but it feels like this vague dream. And that's, again, the sheer intense repetitiveness of the schedule here. And I think it's also because I've been sick for 9 days, so my brain is a bit fried anyway. My immune system is, you know, beaten down. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, one of those cold flu things that leaves your brain a bit messed up. And so I've been still doing these freaking endless shows while also brain fried, and everything's become a bit dreamlike and weird, and I'm just vaguely remembering I had a life before this. I did other things. Yeah, can I leave soon?
It reminded me, I saw an awful movie called Passengers that came out recently. Mm. What's his face from Guardians of the Galaxy and Parks and Rec and
Chris Pratt,
thank you. And I love both of those actors. Not a good movie.
Did you see his magic trick he did on the What's It show?
I didn't.
It's great. It's very good.
Done. Anyway, they're going to another world. It's going to take like 100 years to get there, but he wakes up early. He wakes up 30 years in, and he's stuck on this ship by himself. And like a year goes by in like 20 minutes, essentially, and then he comes up with some other ideas. But just the concept of time passing like that, it was something I related to in terms of repetitive nature, being stuck in one place, not being able to leave.
Well, this was something I saw on The Jerks, thejerks.com, for magicians who, or anyone who doesn't know. Brilliant, brilliant, fascinating, incisive, thought-provoking, magic-related blogger who's anonymous and this amazing, enigmatic figure. Used to write on The Magic Circle Jerk, now writes on The Jerks, J-E-R-X. And he had this piece, among many of his other brilliant things, about this thing that time, as you get older, time tends to pass slower. But one of the things you can do to counteract that is trying to make each day feel as different as possible. Because time goes by quicker when each day is very similar. If you're doing the same thing day in, day out, because there's no distinction, there's no points for your memory to anchor against about what was different over time. So just this blur of, for this 6 months, I went to work every day and came home and watched TV and went to sleep and then went to work every day. Of course it blurs together. So trying to find ways to make your time as different as possible and then to have memories, you know, related to that. And I can relate, the last couple of years, I've had the opposite experience. I've sort of thought of something and went, wait, was that only 3 months ago? It feels like 2 years has passed in the last 3 months, sort of the opposite of, you know, a few years feeling like it went by just in an instant.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so much bizarre, weird stuff has happened. And every day and week and month has been so different, which has been very stressful and very challenging, but definitely not boring.
No, yeah, that's it. I totally agree. I've been experiencing the same exact thing, and repetition is a fancy. I think if you're a performer, you're not really used to that style of repetition because you live the life of a gypsy where it's something different every week.
Well, it depends on the performer. I mean, a lot of performers, you know, their lives are these long-term, multi-month contracts.
True.
You know, magicians, particularly sort of in the US style, are almost an anomaly in that regard.
Yeah, that's true.
So we tend to do mostly once-off and short-term engagements.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I did the Hansa Theatre in Germany, it was the other variety artists I met there. Their lives were these, you know, they do a four-month contract here, then a six-month contract there, and that was default. That was what their life was jumping from long contract to long contract.
Hmm.
And they would occasionally have what in Europe is known as a gala, which is a concept we don't have in
sort of, what is that?
Just a big kind of corporate banquet show, you know, gala, big celebration show.
Oh, gotcha.
And it was interesting because to them they were just a gala. And I don't really know even who runs these things and what they are and how it works. Again, it's amazing how different countries and industries' economies can be and what's normal to them and what's different to other people.
Yeah.
Your subjective sense of normality.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like Arcadio, who's here, who didn't want to be in the podcast.
oh, really? I asked him, and he simply wanted to.
He's from Spain, and he's super self-conscious about his English.
Right.
He speaks fine.
His English is fine.
He's way better than I think most English speakers.
Yeah.
But
my Mandarin.
Yes. Well, no, I don't know. I'm sure your Mandarin's fine.
Well, honestly, it's no better than his English. The difference is I'm less self-conscious about it, so I work it harder.
Yeah.
I get out there and I speak all my Mandarin with energy. And
he's so self-conscious every time when we do bows and he calls us up on stage and says our name, he, like, forgets our name half the time.
Yeah.
And it's clearly from a place of overthinking.
And honestly, that's it right there. I mean, that's silver versus bronze medal, right? He's comparing his English to perfect fluent native English. And yeah, it falls way short of that. Whereas I'm comparing my Mandarin to speaking no Mandarin. I'm like, I got so much Mandarin compared to no Mandarin. And it's probably not far off Arcadio's English. Sure. But I'm comparing mine to zero, going, I have all these words. I'm going to speak them and figure out how to communicate things with these words and be exuberant about mm-hmm. that. Whereas he's frustrated that his English is not flawless. And so he sees that gap, the big, big, huge gap that's... Mm-hmm. ugly and nasty.
Well, we should throw out some Chinese stories because I think that's what the listeners want. Rob the Balloon Guy, a good friend of ours from LA, said he was enjoying some of the Chinese tales.
Oh,
and
man.
Mine this week has been just, yeah, you have some good ones. Mine have been just, I'm just accepting the fact that...
This is the voice of a man who's been in China for 2 months.
Well, I was sitting in the cab.
Beaten down, exhausted.
I'm a naturally empathetic person. I care very deeply about what a stranger thinks of me. And maybe that's why I'm a performer. That makes a lot of sense if you think about it. But we're sitting in the cab yesterday, and it's taken 2 months. But we just sat in the cab, and I showed the cab driver where to go. And as usual, not unusual, he just looks at it, no response to me. No response to the hello I gave him or anything like that. Starts driving.
Yeah. So it is amazing, isn't it? The cab drivers.
It's
I've never
wild.
Experienced as much human loathing.
And now I just... I started seeing them as Google cars that drive themselves. Because I'm like, if I'm in a car with a robot, I don't have to worry about how they feel or how if they're sad or if they're happy. Because I've spent 2 months worrying about the feelings of these cab drivers who could care if we live or die. And putting myself in their situation, which we've done, yes, they probably hate their lives and they hate their job. But a simple hello is anytime I get a cab driver that says, hello, how are you? Sure, no problem. Just simple as that, it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So that's it. I now see cabs as Google self-driving cars, and that makes me less frustrated.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it's so hard to understand from a U.S. cultural point of view, because in China, particularly the mainland, Macau's, again, it's weird. It's a special administrative region of China. But I believe the cabs here are government run, so they're government employees, which basically means they have no realistic possibility of career advancement.
And that's why Uber is illegal here.
Yeah.
You can do it, but it's
shady. Everything is government, you know, at least that, I believe, I could be wrong here, but it's government regulated, at least lots
of things. To put in perspective, Uber, like you have to sit in the front seat of an Uber if you get dropped off at the casino because the police could pull them over for doing it. Yeah,
bust them. Uber is a black market service.
Yeah.
I'm very glad for, because way better than the cabs. So these cab drivers, they have no... Their life is going nowhere. It doesn't matter. If they do a good job, they're not going to get promoted or a pay raise. There's no motivation for them to do a good job or be pleasant, because why would they? There's nothing. And that's such an alien idea to an American, because in America, you know, you can be whatever you want to be, do whatever you want to do, and that's not necessarily true. You can still be an indentured economic slave, effectively, but there is at least the possibility of finding a way to make something work. Whereas here, there basically isn't. If you're a cab driver with no skills... You are in that government, locked in the job by a government who doesn't give a crap, and it's just that's it. So there's no motivation for them to do anything other than go meh and take you to where you're going.
And what's your Chinese story?
Oh, I had a great one. So did we talk about the United Airlines gig?
Oh, we were supposed to.
Yeah, I think that was the week I was sick.
You died. Yeah,
I nearly died.
We had it, yeah, just literally, oh God, yeah, literally the day we recorded the darkest episode in podcast history. That night,
wasn't it?
We had the greatest set of audiences ever because it was a group of Westerners from United Airlines. They purchased the theater.
They did a buyout. It was some kind of, you know, international, like, whole company junket thing. So a lot of their people from the U.S. were in Hong Kong.
So 6 o'clock show, traditional Chinese golf claps.
Yeah.
Golf 8 o'clock, claps, unattentive, 8:30 show, on
their phones, didn't give a shit.
8:30 show, drunken comedy club. Like, amazing. Haven't experienced that in 2 months.
Amazing.
And it was a euphoric energy. Just like, I was dealing with drunks and I didn't even care. I'm like, yeah, go ahead, be drunk. I'm fine with it. Yeah. Go for it.
We had forgotten we'd gone 2 months without a responsive crowd, and suddenly we got one, and it was amazing. We had forgotten what we were talking about it afterwards. We had forgotten what it was like to perform to an audience who actually engaged and connected and reacted well. And it was amazing. And it was, again, the night after that really dark, literally existential, like, thing we recorded.
5 hours after we were just done.
Oh, and it was It was amazing. Place. It was like an oasis in a desert.
That's how wonderful the universe is. It's just a bunch of hills and valleys and ups and downs.
Yeah. And yeah, we were all debriefing afterwards going, wow,
that was a good one.
So I had another one a couple of days ago, and we should post a link to the article. Did you read that Taiwan number one thing I sent you?
Yeah, I saw most of it.
Yeah. There's this whole really interesting article. We'll try and post the link. About basically there's an online, massively multiplayer online game called H1Z1, if you're American. It's a zombie apocalypse, massively multiplayer, survival, horror-type game. And unusually, unlike most massively multiplayer online games, this will be alien to most people, to people who don't know the gaming world, it doesn't have different servers for different parts of the world. Normally you have like an Asian server, and an American server, and a European server, so the people on that play. Whereas this one, a lot of players from China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Korea, and so on are playing on the same server as the Americans and Europeans. And in this game, you can have voice chat, freely open voice chat, between everybody in the lobby between the games. And so for maybe not the first time, but one of the very few times in gaming history, you have lots of Asian players and Western players freely verbally interacting between rounds of this game. And, you know, as gamers tend to do, like sporting fans, you know, talk shit to each other and things like that. And there was this gamer called Angry Pug, is his gaming handle, very good at the game, popular streamer, you know, streams live and many, you know, tens of thousands of people watch him, was trying to find a way to give the Chinese players shit, to kind of insult them, you know, playfully, to try and get them, to get a reaction out of them. He was saying things like, you know, I boned your mom, no reaction, blah, whatever. You know, China sucks, no reaction. America's the best, no reaction. You know, minor reactions, but nothing major. He was really trying to find that raw nerve. And then someone explained, one day someone told him, try shouting Taiwan number one. So one time he tries it, goes, Taiwan number one, and they lost their shit. Which, again, if you don't know anything about the China-Taiwan relationship, it's a very complicated, very, very weird, messed up, antagonistic thing. Basically, Taiwan In Taiwan's view, Taiwan is an independent country. In China's view, Taiwan is a province of China.
Mm.
Obviously, quite a big dispute. And there is, and sort of China doesn't really acknowledge the legitimacy of Taiwan's point of view. And because of the way the education system works in China, most Chinese people don't even understand why Taiwan might be annoyed. They're just not aware of the other point of view. And so there's this weird belligerence to it. So when he shouts Taiwan number one, all these Chinese gamers get really, really angry. And this became a massive viral sensation. And it became an actual part of Taiwanese gaming national identity. And it's now this kind of sort of pro-Taiwan rallying chant of Taiwan number one, on both on gaming and offline. There's now actually a political party called the Taiwan number one party that I discovered while researching this. And again, the whole thing, like, look up the article. It's geopolitically, economically, culturally fascinating. It gives a real insight into this part of the world. So anyway, the other day, I'm doing shows, and again, all the audiences are mostly terrible. They're not terrible. I'm getting used to how to reach them. And
they're not terrible, they're just quiet.
Yeah, just quiet. You know, they've got their own thing. And, you know, I'm now getting much better at getting reactions out of them because I've learned how to adapt culturally to that style a bit more. But it's still, it ain't no Western audience. And then this group comes in. This group comes in. Of maybe about 70 people, big group, looks like a tour group. And they were amazing. They were fun and engaged and aware and on it and intelligent and giving me crap in a playful way rather than an annoying way. It was just really just this amazing crowd. I was going, who are these people? And again, I'm doing the whole show in Mandarin, which is also the language in Taiwan. And I was wondering if they were all from Hong Kong or something. In the show, I say in Mandarin, you know, Niman thought Niman Shinagor, and like, where are you from? And they were like, from Taiwan. And just without thinking, in that improv moment, I was like, ah, Taiwan number one. And they lost their shit. It was amazing. It was
Could have gone so poorly.
Oh yeah, again, because you know, mainland China does not approve of acknowledging Taiwan as a country. So I suddenly was like, oh crap, hang on, are there any Chinese government officials in the room or anything? You know, in the crowd, I didn't know if they were all from Taiwan. You know, I assume most of them clearly were. So I think luckily we avoided a genuine international incident.
You haven't been fired yet. So
yeah,
that's
so
good.
It should be all right. At least as long as no one listens to this podcast. Maybe they just didn't know.
Taiwan, you did that. You did that during the same exact group. I didn't have this group. This group of people did not see my show.
Yeah, they were the Mega Magic only crowd. The warm up.
The crowd before that was the quietest, unresponsive audience I've ever had here. And if it's a quiet audience, I'll really try to make eye contact. I'll try harder. I'll pump up my energy. And I was just getting nothing from it. It's as if they were staring at a blank wall. Mm. And when it gets to that point, that's when you start to get angry. Because it's like, why are you here? You're looking at me like I shouldn't be here. And that's the most frustrating part. And at one point during a very quiet, somber moment, in my show, I look over to the tech to my left and I mind blowing my brains out. And as I did it, I was like, oh, that's probably not a good idea.
Yeah, it's tricky though, because again, you don't know what people's expectations of entertainment are. You have people who have maybe never seen a live show before or have seen almost none who don't understand that we would even care about their response in any way. They don't know that necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, you have to... And again, it's possible that they're just unresponsive assholes, but it's also possible that they're just confused or they don't know or they culturally don't have this concept of interactive entertainment. You know, if you go watch... For example, you go watch a symphony orchestra, you know, you're not expecting any reaction from the audience during the orchestral recital. You know what I mean? For all they know, that's how our performance is meant to be received as well.
But if a violin player wanted to look out into the audience and know whether or not they were enjoying it, they could just look at them and see it on their face. Statistically.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure when I watch an orchestral recital, my face is pretty blank and expressionless, even if I'm loving it.
I don't know. Every quiet crowd I've had here has still had at least a smile on their face or is still acknowledging something
that
is
there's
happening.
At least a sparkle in the eyes of recognition and appreciation.
I felt like I was performing for nobody.
Yeah.
And which is whatever you're getting paid, shut up, dude.
I am aware that I'm definitely a culprit of resting bitch face when watching shows.
No, I am too, but
that's often usually because I hate the show, to be honest. But that's, you know, even when I don't mind the show...
But I am self-aware to know...
That's why I sit in the back row.
Oh, yeah, same. I hate...
To not inflict my face on the performer.
Yeah, I love watching a show from the back because I am not a traditional audience member. But yeah. I know if I'm in an audience, and obviously it doesn't apply to here, but if I know I'm in a quiet audience, I will naturally just be the person who applauds more, who laughs louder to try to get the audience on the side because I know what that performer is going through.
Yeah.
If it's a good show. If it's not a good show, then sorry, you're on your own. But
which reminds me, I had a great moment where Arcadio came in to watch me doing. I was doing this new bit that I was like telling him about, and I was I said you can just come watch it, and I hugely appreciated how he didn't try and lead the applause. I hate it when performers try and lead the applause for me. Yeah. I hate that. Like, don't lead the damn applause. Let the audience be the audience. Like,
I see that with a lot of magicians.
It's an endemic thing at the Magic Castle.
Yeah,
when magicians try and lead the applause, like, don't do it. If they're going to applaud, let them applaud naturally. And if they're not, that's fine. I'm okay with that.
Because they're cueing people to applaud in spots that they didn't they didn't know to, and exactly. B, it may even be giving something away. Because, did something happen there that I didn't catch?
Or just at all. Like, let the audience be themselves. Yeah. Like, you know, that's on me, the performer, to guide them into whatever kind of reaction that we want. And you know what? If they don't applaud, applause is the most important thing in the world. Just they can just enjoy the moment and be stunned as well. That's fine.
And what's so funny about this terrible audience that I was just speaking of, the audience before was also very quiet. But we still went out and did photos with them because it's like, you know what, fine. And every single time, I swear, every single time when it's a quiet audience, they are always the most appreciative ones who want photos with you. They're always the kindest.
Just because they're quiet doesn't mean they're not liking it.
But the show I blew my brains out in, that was not the case. That was something really different.
They really just didn't give a shit.
That was, And that was one of those cases where your Taiwan group was much bigger than the small group we had, and it was just it would have been pointless to go out and see a photo because most of the audience had not seen our show. It's so funny how we were just talking about these quiet crowds, they're really appreciative, and then you just go and have the worst audience, quietest audience ever.
Yeah.
But you bounce back for it, and it makes the crowds that would be mediocre by American standards. Amazing here.
Oh, yeah.
And that keeps you going. It makes it feel like that United Airlines buyout of crazy drunk Western corporate people who are just getting away from their family, and this is their big weekend to party, and you know what? I'm gonna let them party. Have fun.
This contract has definitely made me stronger as a performer.
It's stronger in so many different ways.
So many ways.
I think I have to go buy pants with my wife. So
these are the important tasks.
I only have an hour. I have an hour and a half before shows, and that means I have to get to the pants store. But do you have any last thoughts?
What are the last thoughts? So many. At least we got plenty of material for next week.
We got enough. Yeah, just start jotting some. I got through most of the notes here. There's a couple of things I want to talk about.
I think the biggest thing for me is always, and this is with everything in life, everything in the human condition, is, you know, as we talk about Chinese audiences and Taiwanese audiences and Western audiences, is remembering that it always has to be seen as a set of overlapping bell curves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within any culture, yes, you know, Chinese audiences are among the worst on average that I've ever performed for, which doesn't mean that you don't get some occasionally wonderful audiences or wonderful individuals in those audiences. Saying it's the worst just means the bell curve is skewed very negatively versus the Western ones, which is skewed more positively. You still get terrible Western audiences. Yeah. They're worse than the best Chinese audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so frustrating that most people aren't aware of that concept. Most people just go, no, this category is bad, this category is good, done, end of story, without seeing that subtlety of just the probability distribution within any given situation. Same as, you know, if you look at just physical strength, right? You know, men are physically stronger than women. You look at that, the male bell curve is higher than the female bell curve, but the strongest woman, you know, the strongest X percent of women are much stronger than the lowest X percent of men, whatever those percentage numbers are. In every measurable quantity about anyone or anything, it's so important to remember that you are dealing with skewed bell curves rather than, like, absolute quantities.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the population average of something is only relevant when you're doing a mass marketing campaign. If you're dealing with an individual, all the bets are off. They could be anywhere on that scale, regardless of their race or their culture or their ethnicity or whatever. And often it's the people who are contrary to their parent bell curves are the more interesting people who are more worthy of your time. and hence a reminder never to judge. I've just spoken to so many people here who are like gender roles, for example, are very much more set in stone in China.
Mm. Yeah, that's something this week that's really hit me. Yeah. It's been very depressing. It's
one of my pet peeves that tough. Well, girls do this and guys do this. Yeah. I'm like, sure, maybe in that bulk center at the bell curve, but
feminism has a long way to go here. Oh,
man. It's got a long way to go everywhere, but particularly here. Good luck. Yeah,
it's tough.
Yeah, it's a dark place. But yeah, that reminder that the interesting things usually lie under the tails of the bell curves. And it's amazing just the uphill discussions I've had with people I've met here about, and they're just completely confused as to, you know, why a man might not act in the stereotypical manner of a man the way they're expected to, or vice versa for a woman or a Westerner or an Asian or whatever. It's just, bell curves, people. Everyone's different.
Love thy neighbor. Jesus said that, right?
Get pissed off at your neighbor if they're a racist, sexist dipshit.
Okay. Well, we better end this now before you say things you don't...
Love them anyway. You know, wish them the best. Peace just and then love. Don't spend time around
all
them.
All God's children.
Because they're the worst.
Oh, lovely. All right, well, if you like us, please rate us on iTunes. If you don't like us, don't. Send fan mail or hate mail to twomagicians1mike@gmail.com. And on the social media, I am at Nick Paul Magic. You are at Things by Simon.
I will answer any question sent to me on Twitter at Things by Simon.
Twitter's good. I like Twitter because it's Twitter.
You can actually have a conversation on Twitter.
You can have a conversation.
You can't just send me a photo on Instagram that I'll ignore because Instagram.
Which happened to both of us this week.
We'll get to later. Wow.
We'll get to later.
About that next week.
That's a cliffhanger because we don't know how it ended yet.
No, stay tuned for next week as we talk about a weird, weird, creepy, strange experience we both had.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.